Judges chapter 21. Now the men of Israel had sworn an oath at Mizpah, saying, "None of us shall give his daughter to Benjamin as a wife." Then the people came to the house of God and remained there before God till evening. They lifted up their voices and wept bitterly and said, "O Lord God of Israel, why has this come to pass in Israel, that today there should be one tribe missing in Israel?" So it was on the next morning that the people rose early and built an altar there and offered burnt offerings and peace offerings. The children of Israel said, "Who is there among all the tribes of Israel who did not come up with the assembly to the Lord?" For they had made a great oath concerning anyone who had not come up to the Lord at Mizpah, saying, "He shall surely be put to death." And the children of Israel grieved for Benjamin their brother and said, "One tribe is cut off from Israel today. What shall we do for wives for those who remain, seeing we have sworn by the Lord that we will not give them our daughters as wives?" And they said, "What one is there from the tribes of Israel who did not come up to Mizpah to the Lord?" And in fact, no one had come to the camp from Jabesh Gilead to the assembly. For when the people were counted, indeed not one of the inhabitants of Jabesh Gilead was there. So the congregation sent out there 12,000 of their most valiant men and commanded them, saying, "Go and strike the inhabitants of Jabesh Gilead with the edge of the sword, including the women and children. And this is the thing that you shall do. You shall utterly destroy every male and every woman who has known a man intimately." So they found among the inhabitants of Jabesh Gilead 400 young virgins who had not known a man intimately, and they brought them to the camp at Shiloh, which is the land of Canaan. Then the whole congregation sent word to the children of Benjamin who were at the rock of Rimmon, and announced peace to them. So Benjamin came back at that time, and they gave them women whom they had saved alive of the women of Jabesh Gilead, and yet they had not found enough for them. And the people grieved for Benjamin, because the Lord had made a void in the tribes of Israel. Then the elders of the congregation said, "What shall we do for wives for those who remain, since the women of Benjamin have been destroyed?" And they said, "There must be an inheritance for the survivors of Benjamin, that a tribe may not be destroyed from Israel. However, we cannot give them wives from our daughters, for the children of Israel have sworn an oath, saying, 'Cursed be the one who gives a wife to Benjamin.'" Then they said, "In fact, there is a yearly feast of the Lord in Shiloh, which is north of Bethel, on the east side of the highway that goes up from Bethel to Shechem, and south of Lebona." Therefore they instructed the children of Benjamin, saying, "Go, lie in wait in the vineyards, and watch. And just when the daughters of Shiloh come out to perform their dances, then come out from the vineyards, and every man catch a wife for himself from the daughters of Shiloh. Then go to the land of Benjamin. Then it shall be, when their fathers or their brothers come to us to complain, that we will say to them, 'Be kind to them for our sakes, because we did not take a wife for any of them in the war. For it is not as though you have given the women to them at this time, making yourselves guilty of your oath.'" And the children of Benjamin did so. They took enough wives for their number from those who danced, whom they caught. Then they went and returned to their inheritance, and they rebuilt the cities and dwelt in them. So the children of Israel departed from them from there at that time, every man to his tribe and family. They went out from there, every man to his inheritance. In those days there were no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes.
Thank you, Dave, for reading Judges chapter 21. Before I go into any of my little spiel about it, there may or may not be questions regarding this particular chapter. We're obviously ending the book of Judges today. If you haven't gathered that, there are only 21 chapters in this book. Next time, we'll go on to Samuel. There's a reason we're skipping book of Ruth. We'll come back to that. I'll explain that next time. We'll come back to Ruth at a later date. Any questions about Judges 21? Comments or things that caught your attention? Yes, Pat.
It was very interesting to see how they, after they'd made a rather foolish oath, how they found their way
to get around it. Yes, it's a little finagling on their reasoning. Yes, Ellie.
At least they felt obligated
to try to accept it.
But
at least,
Well,
it wasn't your daughter, you're okay, right?
Yeah.
It was very unwise for Jabesh Gilead not to send some men to the fight.
Probably was. It probably was. Yes, Tammy.
This is a perfect example of y'all made the biggest mess imaginable, and now you come crying to God to rectify it some way.
Yep, yep. That's precisely true. They got themselves a lot of hot water. Poor choices. No doubt. No doubt. Quite a few poor choices were made. And this just was the latest of the many poor choices. That's no wonder why God sent. All right, enough of these people. Let's bring some other military in here and take over and show you people what real life is supposed to be like. Not worrying about one another and dumb decisions. It's probably, yes, yes. Well, God's supposed to be their king at this point in time, but it doesn't seem to work so well.
Well, they consult him after the fact.
But don't we all?
Yeah, because it's like that trait to get out of what they're supposed to be doing. I mean, it's human.
It is. It's all humans doing it.
You see it to this day. In London, there's been huge squabbles because of the Eruv. You know, the boundary markers, they actually have them on the lamp. There's poles being erected in London. And because of the description of what you cannot carry on a Sabbath day and what actually demarcates the
distance allowed traveling.
So in London, I'm not kidding you, they have put poles up that start at one house and go miles out of the way to the other so that they can carry their children and take food and everything to shul. Yeah, and then on top of that, there's another great big bloody argument because of the colour that the Arub is painted, you know. It's that same, okay, we've made a vow.
How do we get out of it? Yes. Yeah, that's all too common, unfortunately. In Judges 21, it's actually concluding our discussion of the last couple of chapters. As I'm sure you all fully recall, the issues that happened with Benjamin and Israel coming to attack, and the loss of about 65,000 people because of poor choices, as Timmy quite clearly pointed out. They have unintended consequences. That's why 65,000 now are dead at this point in the story. And you have obviously just a very few small number of males left of one tribe to try and to save. So we're concluding the chapter. Hopefully we'll have time to recap of the whole book today, which won't take too long. It's just a matter of going through the chapters and figure out what we learned. But I want to go through this one, hopefully not too fast, but relatively quickly. All right. This oath they took in Mizpah. It was not recorded in chapter 20. Why? Because it doesn't matter in chapter 20. It only matters in chapter 21. So just because they got together in chapter 20 and they had what are we going to do? Well, all the conversation wasn't necessarily recorded, just the part that mattered to chapter 20. Well, 21, clearly there was more things going on during that meeting that we weren't told about until now. And this oath is one of them. The drawback of them, the way that they get out of their oath, though, is just horribly disappointing. But we'll deal with that in a minute. So they have this problem. They go to Shiloh, which is where it belongs. The Shiloh's up here on my little map. Ta-da. Jerusalem, of course, is just down here for reference, the bottom of my map, just so you kind of know where things are at. Benjamin's territory is Gibeah, and there's Mizpah, which is a little further north. It's actually close to the border of Benjamin. A little further south here. Between Benjamin and Ephraim. Ramon, which is up in Ephraim's territories, where all these 600 Benjamites ran to. There are cliffs and rocks and various other things up there, which they're hanging out. Not too far from Shiloh, which is easy traveling distance to go grab your brides. Makes logical sense. Close, relatively easy to get to. Yabesh Gilead is way up here. Now, I have it written here in Gad's territory. They're not quite sure if it's actually Gad's or Manasseh's, because Gad's territory, we have duplicate city names. They're not sure if the territory goes up this far, up toward Galilee, or actually comes a little short, because there are some cities here named the same. And the border listings are a little bit questionable. Either way, no matter how you slice it, they're Gileadites. They're descendants of that territory, that region, which mixed Manasseh and Gad together. That incorporated both tribes. It was a group of people named after Gilead himself, who originally settled the area. So that's where our story is taking place. Most of Israel's down here in Mitzpah. Most of the soldiers there, not all of Israel, but the soldiers are down here in that general area. That's, of course, they had their 400,000 man army, and they lost 40,000 of them in the process of attacking Benjamin. So they go up to Shiloh, and what do they offer? They offer elevation offerings and peace offerings in Shiloh. Now, what's the difference? To recall what the difference between an elevation offering versus a peace offering is, and why you would do one or the other, or in some cases both, or neither. In this instance, the going to Shiloh, they're actually required to do both. One is a celebration process, and the other one's a sorrowful process. You lift up to God in elevation because you're grateful. You're wonderful. You're ecstatic with Him. Why? Well, you just won a wonderful battle. And anytime God delivers a battle enemy into your hand, you are to thank Him for it. There is no exception to that rule. But there's a peace offering as well. Why? Because their enemy happened to be their own tribe at the destruction of Israel. They have a conflicting issue going on here. Thus, they have to do both elevation and peace. Elevation, thank God for winning the battle. Peace offering to God, please help us out of this problem we're stuck with. They go to Shiloh, they have these issues, they're offering these offerings up. And another issue they have to figure out, which they have yet to do, and they don't do it here yet either, but they kind of try to figure it out. They still don't know why they lost 40,000 of their own soldiers. The last two chapters we're discussing, I think my personal opinion is quite clear. They lost it because of Jonathan, Moses' grandson. All right, anyway, they're more worried about this concubine and her death and the loss of this horrible tragedy that occurred in Benjamin. Did they care about what happened to the people of Israel up north, the tribe of Dan? But they don't know why. They don't know why they lost 40,000 yet, do they? At any point in time, do they ask God, why did we lose 40,000 men?
There's no evidence.
There's no evidence they ask Him. If they did ask Him, He clearly is not telling them why. But either way, they don't know why. They have to figure it out. What's their first choice? Well, if what we did was right, then that can't be the problem. Maybe somebody caused what we did that would have been right wasn't done correctly. Achan, for example, Achan, back in Joshua, was one man, one family responsible for the death of quite a few hundred Israelites. One man's failure to do something right can cause all the people to suffer, right? Yeah. So they're logically thinking, well, what we did was right. Not believing that what they did maybe would not have been right. They are believing that there's somebody who should have joined us and didn't. Thus, that is why we lost our 40,000 people. It must be the responsibility of this other group or some other group, whoever it may have been, that they're the reason we lost. They're the reason why God was upset, because not all of Israel was angered at this scenario. Not thinking that it could be that Dan would have been the issue or Jonathan would have been the issue, they focus on what they did had to have been right, so somebody else not joining them was thus wrong. Let's go attack the person who didn't join us. Seemed reasonable in their eyes. Reasonable choice to make. That's what they did with Achan back in Joshua's time. Who is it? Who was the problem? Who's the guilty party? Oh, there he is. Go get him. But see, Joshua asked God. These people did not. They even asked God why this went bad, why they lost 40,000, why a tribe of Benjamin is now dying. They made their own choices. So they still have to figure this out, which is amongst the other reasons why you have peace offerings. God, please help us. Please show compassion and explain this. What is happening to us? Their choices. Now, we discussed in previous chapters that this is completely out of the sequence of what they were supposed to do regarding legally. If you have an issue with a tribe who did something morally corrupt, there's a trial. There must be a trial that occurs. The trial occurs usually in one of the main cities. Shechem happens to be the closest one, but there's Hebron, which is further south, not too far away. A trial occurs. You open up the books of the Torah. Did you break the law? Yes or no? Where are the witnesses? Did any of that occur? No, it didn't. What did happen? It was a trial, judge, jury, and executioner without the parties even being present to represent themselves.
It wasn't even done in God's...
In Shiloh. It was done way up here in Mitzvah. With all their swords and military stuff ready to go. They already had their verdict long before they even got there. There was no trial. There was no procedure. You don't get to step outside of the law just because you think you're doing something right. That's not allowed. You still must stay within the law's bounds, whether you like it or not. So they didn't do that. They made their own trial. They came to their own conclusion. And what was the result? All parties suffered. Israel lost 40,000. Benjamin loses 26,000. 25,000, roughly. 65,000 people dead. The case where a tribe is about ready to die off. Bad results. All of them bad results. Results unexpected, undesired. Maybe they didn't go through God. They did it on their own. So, of course, they look around, they find out Jabesh Gilead, which we're not sure whether it's part of Gad or part of Manasseh. None of the males were there. So what would be the first response you would do if the males didn't show up? Well, your instinct, assuming that you thought you were right, why would they just go kill the males? Why would they kill the women and their children? Jabesh Gilead is also Israelites, by the way. You're killing the males who were there who could have come to battle. You're killing their wives. You're killing their children as well. Isn't that just more evil being paid for an evil act to start with? Yeah, it is. Now, yes, those commentators say, well, yeah, but it was because the women influenced the men not to show up. Oh, please. I'm sorry. Women don't make the choice of going to war or not. It's not their decision. It's the male's decision. And how many men would it have taken for Jabesh Gilead to make this situation go away? Just one. Send one. Assuming he wasn't amongst the 40,000 who died. In which case, they don't know who he is. But assuming that's not the case, sending one would have fixed it. But they killed the women and children as well to get out of their oath. A stupid oath they took. An oath that had no business being there. They're not allowed to take oaths arbitrarily. It's a foolish oath. You take a foolish oath, you pay for it. Had they gone to the high priest or the temple at the time and said, hey, we are in an oath situation here. We have to get out of it. Well, the high priest actually has the ability to inquire of God and ask him, how do you get out of this oath? But did they do that?
They didn't do that, yeah.
They didn't. Yes, Pat.
Would they have become responsible for taking care of those wives and children had they not killed them? Was that part of the motivation?
Yes, they would have been responsible to take care of them because they're Israelites as well. Actually, not they, it's their tribe. The tribe that they belonged to have been actually more responsible. So if it was, for example, if they were Gad rather than Manasseh, the males or their cousins and relatives in the tribe of Gad would have the responsibility taking care of those women and those children until they were of age. That would have been of normal circumstances. It was Manasseh with Manasseh. And it was Manasseh in both sides of Manasseh, not just one side. Both sides were responsible for it. Now, yes, but that's a financial issue, though. Oh, I don't want to take care of these women and children. Let's just kill them off. That's not exactly the godly choice to make by any stretch of the imagination. It was a very poor choice. Very poor results were the consequence. Yeah, it's just a disappointing scenario. So they go to Jabesh Gilead, 12,000 soldiers go up there, they wipe out the town, take 400 women, and give them to the Benjamites in Vermont. Obviously, there are 600 males. You have 400 women. They're short. They're short 200. Now is when they start to figure out how do we get out of the oath. Why didn't they start thinking about this earlier? Before they killed all the people of Jabesh Gilead. Now, mind you, were the people of Jabesh Gilead wrong? Not necessarily. Because the tribe of Benjamin, though was also wrong, they didn't go up to Mizpah either. Now granted, they died. They were killed for it. But if a trial was going to be had, would it have been happening down here in Mizpah? No. If a trial for the tribe of Benjamin needed to occur, it would have occurred up here in Shechem or near Shiloh, which kind of trial was going on, whether it was a high priest ruling over or whether it was the judge. Or maybe down in Hebron. Then would the people of Jabesh Gilead have shown up? Maybe. Because then it's legal. Then you're inside the law. So Jabesh Gilead, they didn't show up. But they weren't necessarily wrong for not showing up.
Unless they swore an oath they'd be there.
Right, but nobody has sworn an oath that they were going to be at Mizpah.
Yeah.
Only people at Mizpah swore the oath after they arrived. Jabesh Gilead, there is no indication that any of that has been recorded. They swore the oath that they would be there. That would have been another issue. But there's no indication they were wrong for not showing up. There's clear indication they were punished for it. But they weren't necessarily wrong. So now they're trying to figure out a way out of the oath. What's the method? What did they come up with?
It was a holiday coming up.
So kidnap a few. We take a few. Now see, had they said that however many lives in Jabesh Gilead died ago, before they went up to attack them, that would have worked, wouldn't it? Oh, well, we made this stupid oath. We're trying to get out of it. Well, we just won't give our children as wives to them. They'll have to take them. But we just won't give it to them. That's all. Now we're out of the oath. See how simple that is? Now, that solution existed before they attacked Jabesh Gilead. They didn't see the solution, because they didn't need to see it. They thought they were in the right, and yet they were not. Not once did they make any right decisions along this whole process, because not once did they ask God, what is the right decision? So we have no clue what the right decision actually should have been or would have been. God most likely would have said, go fix Jonathan up north. Then we'll deal with Benjamin afterward. You fix my house and fix what you guys have screwed up, then we'll fix yours. That's my inclination, what God would have done, because that's his track record of the Torah. You fix the temple first. You have to fix the tabernacle first. You get that thing up and running first. Then we'll deal with what you guys need. That's kind of a process which you seem to go through. So they reinterpret their oath. They obviously just don't give. They allow Benjamin to take. And this is where prophecy comes true. Benjamin the wolf. Back in the book of Genesis, chapter 49, verse 27. You don't have to go there. I don't think I recorded it the word verbatim, did I? No, I didn't. I have to go back myself. So this is the blessings that Jacob and whatnot is. He was exposing on all of his sons and everything else. This is Genesis chapter 49, verse 27. Now, I'm hoping to, as we go through all of the prophets, come back to each of these blessings that Jacob gave. So maybe this is the second one we've come to. Third one. Second one I've come to, one of them fulfills itself inside the book of Genesis, but doesn't count. So the second one that I've come to, of the blessings coming true. Now here's Benjamin's blessing from Jacob. Benjamin is a ravenous wolf. In the morning he shall devour the prey, and at night he shall divide the spoil. Now, how does that prophecy apply here in the book of Judges? Now, you go to the Christian commentaries, and they'll all say, oh, well, it's the battle. It's the fighting. It's the war that took place. That's just, unfortunately, not very well thought out. Because they're looking at, well, a ravenous wolf is one who attacks and who kills and devours. And, of course, is dividing the spoil and like that. Well, that's great and wonderful. Benjamin fought against Israel. Benjamin kills them. The first two onslaughts, Benjamin wins. Obviously, he's winning. Obviously, he's ravenous. He's dangerous. And he's taking everything he has. No, Benjamin doesn't take anything. There's no spoil in those battles that Benjamin takes. They run back to their cities and wait for the next attack. So that's not actually a really good application. But then if you look up what it actually means to be a ravenous wolf, it means to be a wolf that grabs. One that takes. One that just takes what they want and runs. Isn't that what wolves do? Look around. Look at the natural world. You see wolves. They're in packs. They're in groups. Small packs, not big ones. They find something they want, they take it, and they run. They go away. Or they stick around if it's too big to run with, and they kind of eat it there and then run. But either way, they run. They grab what they want and they run. Benjamin just did that with these 200 women, didn't they? They grabbed just what they needed, and they ran. So are they the grabbing wolf? Well, they even had to hide and lie in wait, as a wolf would do, and see their prey coming around. Yes,
Samuel,
Susan.
It must be said that those girls should not have been in the vineyard dancing. There is ancient sources that show that it was a very Canaanite, pagan feast at the end of the year, right around what became the feast of
Sukkot.
And that those girls were probably, they'd been drinking.
Possibly. There's one other possibility that may also be going on here, which we'll hopefully get to today. Yeah, I should be able to get to today. Yes, you're right. There is a Canaanite practice at the time, and had been for many, many, many years, and will be for quite a while to go. Place yourself in the shoes of an Israelite person who knows there's a God but doesn't really know a whole lot about him. You're going into new territory. You are not a farmer. You don't know the first thing about growing anything. You're a nomad. You're a shepherd. You don't grow food in ground. It comes out of an animal. You buy ground food. You buy it from people who sell stuff. You don't sit there and grow it yourself. You go into new territory. You inherit this whole land. Holy cow, how do I take care of this? What do I do? How do I process this? Does the Bible tell me, give you agricultural instructions on how to take care of crops? No, it doesn't have to harvest them. Okay, that's great, but I have to get the harvest before that's going to happen. So what do? The first thing is you look over the fence. What's my neighbor doing? Oh, okay. Come on back. You look at what your neighbor's doing first, which is a natural human instinct. I don't know what I'm doing, but he does. Hey, buddy, how do I do this? Oh, well, we grab all of our rocks and we put them in piles and we dance around them or we to get rain to come. Oh, okay, pile rocks, dance, try to get rain. You adopt your neighbor's practices, whether they are good or evil. Because you may not be aware of how to do anything. Now, that's one thing that's going on as a nation as a whole. All right, that is correct, because they're very early on in their harvesting, or they're taking over this land. It even points out at the end of the chapter, then they go off and take their inheritance. They haven't even taken it all yet, so they're just starting out here. Now, that being an underlying theme that's consistent with every tribe and every territory, there's something else also going on here with the same scenario with these women who are dancing in the vineyard. Yes, it's a vineyard. So what are they dancing for? It's a harvest time. Most likely it's Sukkot. It's grapes. That's what they're doing. They're also from Shiloh, where the priesthood is at, and where all the Levite priests and everything else, that all the, quote, educated, in a quote, people live, educated in the Torah. Whose daughters are these women? Well, some are going to be priests' daughters, not the high priest. We're talking Levites. Some are going to be amongst them, amongst other tribes too. It's obviously Ephraimite. You probably have some Manasseh because it's relatively close to the border. There's a couple of women. It's probably a pilgrimage festival, which is also required for festivals, pilgrimage to Shiloh. So you have a lot of conflicting good and pagan things going on inside this territory. They're very early on. How many of them can read? I highly doubt much of greed at all.
They weren't far.
Not that they're dumb. I'm just saying that they are not going to be highly educated Torah literate individuals yet. We know that because Manoah was not, and he even lives thousands, hundreds of years later. Samson's father, not Torah literate. Is Micah Torah literate? He lived before these guys did. Well, he's still alive, actually. No, he's not Torah literate. He has a general idea, but that's about it. So that's the kind of general education level that's going on here. Did these women know Moses? Maybe. If so, they were very, very little kids, little children. Not likely, though. Their parents most likely did, but they probably did not.
They would know Joshua.
They would have known Joshua, because he would have lived in that area as well. Or he's dead now at this point, but he would have lived around there too. So all that's going on. Are they pagan rituals? Susan's right. Yes, there's pagan rituals going on here. Is it also being incorporated into Israelite Judaism, if you can call that term? Yeah, they are. Pagan rituals are being incorporated into. Right or wrong, they're happening. But this is my point. Because some of these women happen to have been Levitical daughters, what is the current tradition regarding the tribe of Benjamin? What is their unique trait that they are classified as having?
Left hand
is a physical trait. What's a spiritual trait?
Studiers of the scripture.
Studiers of the scripture. Orthodoxy is what they're considered. What are the chances the 200 women that were grabbed? There are a higher population of Levitical priesthood daughters in there. My guess, because this prophecy was very important from Jacob, and this is not a negative prophecy, by the way. Jacob isn't lamb blasting Benjamin for being a wolf and grabbing and dividing the spoils. This is a good thing. My personal opinion is that this is the source of where Benjamin starts correcting itself, where Ehud comes from, the second or third judge of Israel, after Othniel and Joshua. That's my opinion, because of where it's happening, the time of year it's happening, and what Benjamin needs most in their survival. Torah. My personal opinion there. That's just my personal opinion. Because that seems to be consistent. And granted, yes, technically, yeah, it's Jewish tradition. But still, it doesn't matter. I happen to agree with that tradition. I think there's a good chance the select 200 women were likely, a percentage of them, more percentage, higher percentage of them, were likely to be priestly women because of where their families were and where they were at. Yes, Ellie.
And for these women to have been drinking and dancing is within the commandments of God because it's Sukkot.
It's a holy day, right. Drinking is not an issue. Dancing is not an issue. What are the reasons they're maybe dancing in the vineyard? We don't know. That's not described as far as... Was it a pagan ritual? It very well could have been. Was it still occurring during Samuel's time? Most likely. 300 years later. It's an annual tradition, most likely. Yes,
yeah, because
Susan.
When they first went to go into the land, what did the spies bring back? They brought back grapes. That was obviously the industry of that particular
that area.
Part of the area. They would have, well, we live in grape cult. Just look at what happens at the end of the year. At harvest time, there was a huge celebration.
Huge celebration, which,
on many levels, you could say it's quite pagan.
In some ways, the levels they are, yes.
And we can identify with that. We live in it. We continue to be faithful in it. And it's never a cut and dry picture. You've always got
overlapping
faithful remnant. You've always got those on the borders that get sucked into what is called religious syncretism, which is a blending. And that was to be Israel's sin all the way through.
And it still is in many ways. It will not end until God straightens it.
Exactly, exactly.
That's true.
I just think it's interesting that, I wanted to say one other thing, Dan. When you think about wolves, we think about wolves in very negative frame today.
Right, we do.
But we're actually in the process of reintroducing wolves back into our environment because they serve a very valuable purpose. But actually, when people have studied them, they're intelligent, they're loyal, they're faithful. If a mother dies, the cubs are taken care of by another. I mean, wolves are actually, it's quite a good thing to be a wolf.
It is. Very intelligent. It is.
There's
a reason why dogs come from them. And we love our dogs. And of course, they're obviously considered intelligent dogs or very smart. They're all the derivatives of the same animal. They are very smart. They're pack animals. We are pack people. We have our families. We have our little groups we stick around with, just like dogs do. There's no difference there. I like this one section, which is, I think, the only redeeming part of this whole story, is Benjamin grabbing these 200 women. That's my opinion. The only redeeming part of Benjamin tribe and the rest of Israel is the fact they grabbed these 200 women.
They didn't grab 400.
Exactly. They didn't take more than they needed. They took what they needed. They took the spoils. They ran away. Went back home. And they rebuilt their cities. Perfect. Perfect ending to a horrible series of bad choices. I like that one aspect of this story. Unfortunately, this story takes place so much earlier on in the book of Judges, I wish it wasn't placed way back here at the end. But of course, had it not been placed here, it would have made the first chapter very long. Because you'd have, and then right after this, Othniel, the Aram comes, Kushan, whatever, Syria, comes and takes over Israel. Why not? They just lost 65,000 people. Very easy pickings now.
And basically a civil war.
Yeah, they just had a civil war. Yeah, we can take them over. Not an issue. Why would that be needed? Because according to Simon Othniel, they were worshipping other gods. Anybody want to guess which god that was? Or which party was responsible for that? Jonathan. Worshipping other gods. Jonathan. I'm sorry, I'm picking on that guy. He did a really bad choices. And I believe he is the core, not say wholly responsible, but the core of this issue. Moses' grandson. I think he's the core of this issue of what happens to the tribes of Israel and Benjamin. My personal opinion. Okay. Alright, now I got a little bit of time left. I told you I would go through all the books as I finish it, so quick recap. Judges chapter 1. What did we learn from Judges chapter 1? Nothing I remember, because I didn't remember. I had to look it up again. Tribes took their inheritance, or were taking it. But what's the one thing each tribe failed to do?
Run everybody out.
Get rid of the inhabitants. Why? What happened? They became thorns in their sides. As Susan just quickly pointed out, traditions started to pop up that were not Israelite. Things that were not holy started to be brought in. Micah's graven image. The process of Jonathan heading up north and becoming the second high priest. Traditions started to show up that were not acceptable to God. Idol worship begins. And what began? What in chapter 2 we learned it was not the generation from Joshua that started it. And all chapter 2 says it is the next generation that started it. Well, we learned from Benjamin who was responsible in Gibeah. The younger generation was. Was Jonathan part of Joshua's generation? No, he was the next generation. Both of them part of the second generation started the process of idol worship. Because the older generation was dying off. The old man that was in Gibeah that told the Levite, don't stay in the square, he was part of the first generation. He was not the corrupt individual. He tried to tell, hey, Levite, get out of here. This is a dangerous place. You don't want to be here. It wasn't that generation, it was the new one that was having the issues. So, unfortunately, God brings upon Moab and brings upon Aram or Syria to come over and take over Israel. We have Othniel, of course, defeats the Aram's army 8 years later. And then Ehud defeats Moab with his guts and poop spilled out all over the place. With his wonderful little cubit long sword, because he's a left-handed man, Benjamin. And what does it happen in the third chapter? The Philistines arrived. The invaders arrived. Why did they arrive? Because Israel still wasn't doing its job. The whole region along here that incorporates Dan and Judah, which we call the Gaza Strip, was any of it ever conquered? This is almost 100 and something years later. Was it ever conquered? Did Judah ever go battle over there? Did Dan go to battle over there? No. They did not get rid of those inhabitants. Well, God said, I'm going to get rid of the Canaanites. If you don't do it, I will raise someone else up who will. And guess what? Philistines show up. Guess what? All the Canaanites in that area are dead. They did the job that Israel wouldn't do. You don't do your job, God finds somebody else who will. That's a lesson we all learn. The final straw of chapter 4, we go through the big war up north with Sisera and Deborah and Barak, and they all fight this wonderful battle because the Israelites are completely and thoroughly unarmed. They don't have a thing to fight with, but they fight and they win. And the woman goes off, Yair, I think her name was, and kills Sisera with the whole tent pegged to the head and kills the right crew. What did we learn from that, though? Well, that story was about a woman doing what a man was supposed to do. If you won't do it, just like we learned in chapter 3, I'll find somebody else who will. And Barak wasn't willing to do it. He said, no, Deborah, you come with me. Fine, Barak. You're not going to do it. You're going to, quote, stand up and be a man. I'll find somebody, a woman, who will. And it is humiliating. He lost. He didn't get it. She got the glory. He didn't. She got the song in the following chapter, which Song of Deborah has all the praises about, oh, what wonderful Barak and Deborah. And then there's Yair. Guess what? She sliced his head off and did all these wonderful things. And she gets all the praise for killing him. The general, the big, bad, evil man. Do your job. Do what God asks you to do. If you're not willing to do it, he'll find somebody else who will. It's a consistent theme. He'll find somebody else who will. And then we move on to the next group of saved. Oh, yes, Bill.
Where are you at?
Oh, I am going through all the chapters of Judges that we processed, what we learned over the past, 8 months? Man, it's a long time. Going through this book. It happens to be doing it once every 2 weeks. I just completed the first 5 chapters. So I'm going through chapter 6 right now. Gideon. Unwilling savior, the unlikely guy. The guy didn't know anything, doesn't have anything. Part of the weakest family. didn't want to be a savior. But he did anyway. Because God said, no, I'm selecting you. Raise you up, becomes the savior of Israel, and then he has his downfall at the end. He creates his family as a priesthood. He creates the echad, or the ephod, and the breastplate and everything else associated with the high priest and brings it into his household. So this is where I will worship my God. Yes, Tammy.
We'll see that later on in the whole story of the Maccabees and this and that.
Same, yep.
You know,
same scenario. Yep.
In the reverse.
Yeah,
the
priestly
family.
The priestly family.
Want to become king.
Right. The process of bringing the priesthood where it doesn't belong,
yeah.
Bringing God's house where it doesn't belong, happens all the time. Over and over and over again in this book and as well as throughout the rest of most of the Bible. So he did something he should have done at the end of his life. Did he pay for it? No. All of his sons paid for it. All but two were killed by Abimelech, the next judge. Slaughtered all of his brothers with 70 brothers. Killed every one of them, save one. Who then prophesied, Abimelech, you're going to get burned up and destroyed because of who you are, what you've done, and what you're trying to be. So, of course, yeah, unfortunately, that's just the way life is. So, Abimelech, we'll get to Abimelech in a minute here. Gideon's story doesn't end yet. We're going through chapter 6 and 7 and 8. He was going through the process of conquering this last bit of Midianites. Midianites had come over and attacked. They had taken over the area at the time. What was Gideon's Achilles heel while he was still fighting? Succoth and Phanuel. Two cities that 300 men of Gideon were trying to travel through and saying, please give us provisions. We're still chasing this thousands of Midianite army. And what did Succoth and Phanuel do? No. Won't do it. God's not with you. Prove it. When you have them, their head on fire, then we'll give you supplies. And that's a problem. Even if you as a person or I as a person do not know or understand or see if God is with someone. I don't know if you're acting on God's behalf or your own. You still know what is right. You may not know if a person is right, but you know an act is right. The act of attacking Midian, Succoth and Phanuel knew was right to get rid of them. They were being oppressed, but they weren't willing to do it. Just because you don't necessarily know if God's doing something doesn't mean you can't recognize actions that are occurring as being godly. They chose not to recognize or acknowledge those actions. They then paid for it by thorns and various other things that happened to both those two cities and their people that were in charge. And of course, Abimelech comes along, the next generation, kills off all his brothers and then dies a couple years later. What do we learn from Abimelech, though? What did he learn from Abimelech? Okay, well, what happened to him? We learned that he was obviously one of Gideon's sons. He killed 70 of his brothers. 69, sorry. One missed. And he didn't kill himself. There's 71 children total. Killed 69 of his brothers. And became king, or actually judge of Israel. And of course he does bad things and various things happen to him, he dies. What do we learn from him though? Well, does every judge that, quote, God selects, the right judge? Well, as far as the people of Israel are concerned, Abimelech took out a ungodly family because they took over and tried to take part of the priesthood away. So far as the rest of Israel sees, well, that's not necessarily a bad act. Every act he did there subsequently was. God will use any tool he needs, whether it be evil or good, but that is still a tool. So we do learn a little bit from Abimelech, though he was a schmuck to no end. don't like him, don't care for him. We learn something from him. He wasn't a righteous man by any means. He did one act that was halfway decent, and that Gideon's sons needed to be punished because of Gideon's actions. Not killed, but punished. That's the only good thing he did. But all of Israel still followed him, in spite of what his actions were not necessarily godly. Now, Sukkoth and Peniel, we just learned from the previous generation, actions must be godly. You don't may not recognize when God's with somebody, but you recognize the actions being godly. Thus, follow the actions. Well, here, you don't know if God's with him, but the actions are ungodly. Don't follow him. It's still a lesson to be learned. Yes, yeah, see what they do, not what they say. Abimelech may have been judged. It doesn't mean he had the authority to be evil. He still was just a man. And they still chose to follow him. Oh, chapter 10, God gets fed up and says, forget you people, I don't want you, I'm not going to deliver you. You're on your own. And they plead. Said, no, God, don't abandon us. He said, well, I have saved you, what, 7 or 8, 10 times, whatever it is already. And every time you go right back. I don't need this. I don't need you. I'll start over again. But he's a merciful God. He is a merciful God. And he doesn't abandon them completely. He said they just didn't deserve to be saved. He saved them, yes, just didn't deserve it. He was getting fed up at this point in time. Tells you that God has his patience limits too. That's the lesson we learn from that. That eventually God says, hey, enough is enough. You're not getting the lesson. You're not understanding what's going on. You won't listen to me. Why should I have to listen to you? It's a hard thing to hear from God. But yeah, that's what they had to listen to. That's what they heard. That's the lesson they got from that. God has his limits as well. Because in chapter 10, they weren't just worshiping other gods. As it points out, they weren't even worshiping God anymore. They had just outright replaced him completely. Well, now you know where his limit is. If you reject me completely, guess what? I reject you completely. Move on. He almost did it back to Moses. Moses, I'll kill these people off. We'll start over with you. Moses pleaded. God had compassion. He saved him anyway. Well, in this case, Israel pleads. God has compassion. He saves him anyway. Fortunate guy. And good thing he did, because Jephthah was the next ruler. Jephthah was a good man. Yes, he was a marauder. Yes, he was a thief. He was a bad things happened. He was not a very pleasant person to deal with. He had killed people. Yes, he was very talented at it. You know, what judge didn't kill people? But he did few things right. And one of his key things throughout his story, he knew the law. He knew the Torah. He knew what happened and when it happened and what the history was. He followed it, very, very righteously followed it. Just because he's a killer doesn't mean he doesn't believe in God or doesn't follow the Torah. Because Torah doesn't say you can't kill bad people. It just says you can't kill good people without a trial. You can kill bad people, that's okay. So what did Jephthah do? He was a talented warrior. From Gilead. He killed bad people. Which is why he became judge. He said, we need somebody who knows how to kill these bad people. He said, you know what? I can do it. I'll do it. And he knew the law. He does a long dialogue between him and Ammon saying, wait a minute. This is the history, Ammon. King of Ammon. I can't remember that name off the top of my head. This is the history. This is how life went. You have no rights to this territory anymore. Get out of here. And Ammon refused. Sounds familiar today. The Palestinians refuse. Yes, Ellie.
Okay, the fact that he was a Gileadite.
Yes.
Was it common knowledge in Gilead to know the Torah, or was he just an unusual one? Because if it was, maybe why those guys didn't follow after the
Gilead guy. Has a track record of being one that says, yes, this is what the group does, and I will stand over here. That's Gilead's tradition. This is why they're not liked by most of Israel. The Gileads. All of Israel does this, all stay unity, and Gilead stands on the outside and says, and watches. Their other talent is they pull out a sword and they can kill anybody they want. Because they stand outside. That's their tradition, that's their trait of Gilead. Which incorporates part of Gad and part of Manasseh's trait. Manasseh, mind you, this section over here was dominated and taken over by what portion of Manasseh? Machir, the warriors. The people who were adept at killing anything that walked. We'll run across a few of them later on, too. They're still good at it. They're still good at it many years later. They didn't lose that talent.
It didn't bother them.
It didn't bother them. They didn't mind. If you're evil, I'll kill you and I'll move on. I might take your stuff. I might not. But I'll move on. That's their talent. That's their technique. But they did stand out. They were separate. They were separate themselves. They preferred to be separate. They also had a trait of being the generals that were ruling. They're the ones who, when an army gathered together, guess who ruled? Well, according to the Book of Deborah, the people from Machir ruled. They're the ones who direct the army. All right, you group, you go there. You do this, do that, whatever. I'm not a general. I don't know how you rule armies. But those are the traits of the people who live in that area.
Did not the Gadites also...
They were mixed.
Study?
Because
on their tent...
You know, I don't know. I'm not sure. I can't answer that question. I don't know. And the only way you'd be able to answer that question, the only reason they've allocated that study word to Gad, it's just the word study, is because law. Let's see, was it law? What's the word? Law? Not lawless. Is lawgiver? Oh, something like that. Word lawgiver is translated in English during Deborah's song, referring to the people of Gilead, which mix Gad and Manasseh together. Lawgiver. Well, yes, that is the word, but it's also equally translated as general. So you don't know which one it really is. Given Gilead's history, I'd have to say general is their natural technique and status. Lawgiver, well, maybe. I don't know. Hard to say.
He wins a war, makes the rules.
That's true. That's fair. Then he does give the law. All right, I'm going too long. Okay, I'm going a little bit faster. I apologize for this. So Yeftha wipes out Ammon. Ephraim gets upset, says, you didn't invite us to the party, which had he, it wouldn't have worked anyway. So causes civil war. What's Yeftha do? He wins. That's his job. That's what he's good. He's talented at winning. So he defeats Ephraim and they lose. Ephraim loses 40-something thousand soldiers. Because Ephraim, he speaks a different dialect of Hebrew. S versus SH. You got to remember that.
Yep.
There's a reason why in Hebrew there is no such letter for an SH versus an S. Yeah, there's some F, but that doesn't really count. The little dot. But see, the dot was added later. Same thing with the B and the V. And the Pe and the Fe. The F and the P. Because some dialects pronounce it with an F, some pronounce it with a P. The ones who can't pronounce F, they use it with the P. The ones who can't pronounce
it. The perfect example, in Korean, for example, they cannot pronounce the word coffee. It's copy.
Exactly.
You're making a copy.
It's a different dialect. Exactly. It doesn't work. So, and what does Yeftha know about the Ephraimites?
They can't
say the SH sound. Couldn't. I don't care now, but they couldn't at the time. It's all right. You'll say this word.
They say, schedule.
Yeah.
That would go by.
Yeah. Well, okay, let's get off that debate real quick. So he was good at that. He's a winner. He's a talented guy, so he kills him off, and of course, Ephraim backs off. Why was Ephraim so upset? Well, they're trying to get themselves dominancy and take over all the northern tribe, which eventually they do, but not quite yet. Okay, right after them, guess what? God runs out of judges. There are no more good people left. So what does he do? Let's create one called Samson. We don't have a judge to select. I'm going to create the judge that exactly what I want. and Samson's life was a never-ending metaphor and simile. A disaster in many ways. But his life and his process and how he spoke and all of his times he opened his mouth was always a parable of some form or some kind of a riddle. It tells you the kind of mind he had. It may also tell you the kind of mind that God has. God created Samson. All right, he didn't just pick him. He created him. Said to Phinehas' wife, I am giving you a child now, and this is what the child is going to do. He created him. Created his mind to do and say exactly what God wanted his mind and his mouth to say. Gives you an insight a little bit of what God thinks and how he talks. Good luck trying to understand him, because it took me forever to figure out what Samson was saying. He's a human being who lived like thousands of years ago and have a whole lot of commentaries to help me. So I don't understand how God's mind works, but Samson's mind was quite interesting. Yes, he has a riddle. What was his final riddle? Not final, the most important riddle. From the 84th king.
Jawbone.
Yeah, well, that's a different one. I won't go for the firstborn, jawbone, donkey's jawbone yet, the heaps. But from the eater came forth food, for the strong came forth wheat with sweetness. What is sweeter than honey? What is stronger than a lion? What was the answer? Freedom. And God. He was trying to break free from Philistines. Freedom and God is the answer to the Philistines' riddle when they riddled back to Samson the answer. Again, God's weird sometimes. He has an odd sense of mind and timing. And I don't understand him very well, but that was quite well done. Anyway. Yes, and yes, there's a donkey, and that's the point. What was the point of the lesson of the donkeys? The heaps upon the thousands of people, or a thousand people that Samson killed. There's a couple of lessons, but there's one I want to focus on.
Similar to the firstborn.
Similar to the firstborn, yes. Donkeys are the firstborn. Say it again?
Burden bearer.
Burden bearer, yes. Which is what Samson was doing at this point on. He was bearing the whole burden of all of Israel. He didn't deliver them, but he was bearing their burden, which was the Philistines. Get my note here, just in case I forgot it. Yes. But the story with Samson, when he asked the Israelites who were coming to arrest him, he said, are you going to harm me? They said, no, we're not going to harm you. We're just going to arrest you and turn you over to the Philistines. He said, okay, go ahead and arrest me. They arrest him and walks over. After he's turned over to the Philistines, it's when God's strength comes upon him. It tells you God chooses when and where his timing is going to be. Had Israel chosen to harm Samson earlier on, would God's strength come and save Samson and kill Israel, kill the Israelites? Highly unlikely, because he hadn't at any point in time in Samson's life given Samson extra strength while he was attacking Israel. God wasn't trying to attack Israel. God was trying to have issues with the Philistines, and that's what he was going after. God chooses his timing. God chooses when he gives this blessing, when he gives his strength, when he does not. And of course, when Samson lost his hair, God took it away. Even though Samson's hair grew back, God was not obligated to give his strength back to wipe out the rest of the Philistines. But he did anyway, because God chooses his timing. He chooses the people he wishes to help. And what's the last thing we learned of Samson's lesson? When he was lying to Deborah? Truth is always self-evident. All the lies that he gave to Deborah, oh, well, bind my arms, you know, weave my hair, was anything as self-evident as cut my hair. And self-evident, I mean, when you look at someone and they're telling you the truth, and you recognize it's the truth because every fact and evidence surrounding that person, the scenario, and everything you've seen, it fits. Now you know they're telling you the truth. It's how you and I know when someone's telling us the truth. How we recognize it. How do I know if I'm being thoroughly lied to? I don't. But I do know when I'm being told the truth. Delilah saw at that moment, she said, her mind, she realizes, now You're telling me the truth. Because now all the evidence supports it. I may not know if you're lying to me, but I know when I'm hearing the truth. That's the key. That's what we learn from Delilah and Samson's story at the end there. Because we have to take that same lesson. We may not know when someone's lying to us, but we will know when the truth is there, when it's revealed. It's self-evident. The things around it support truth. They don't support lies. You might get one or two bits that support the lie. That's the nature of lies. But all the evidence supports what truth is. All of it. And of course, the last two stories we show up with Micah, his graven image, Jonathan, the grandson of Moses. We've gone to that quote most recently. Most of the story from Micah and Jonathan is about Jonathan, though we don't know his name till the very end. What do we learn from it? It's a false prophet, it's a false priest. Due to Jonathan's work, and it points out quite clearly in that chapter, in chapter 18, or 18 or 19, it's 18, that at the end of it says, and Jonathan becomes the high priest of northern Israel all the way through until the exile. 500 years? 700 years. 700 years go by. He is the high priest of the northern tribes. When the kings break apart and they go to the north, and sometimes the tribes separate north and south, the north tribe has its own high priest. All the line of Jonathan, descendants of Moses. Just because Jonathan was a grandson of Moses doesn't mean he's right. And doesn't mean he can't be taken care of and gotten rid of. Because he does something that is wrong. Inheritance or heritage doesn't mean anything. Lineage doesn't matter. It strictly matters what God selects. And when somebody steps outside the bounds, he steps outside. That's the lesson we're supposed to learn. And to not be afraid to act, because unfortunately all of Israel was afraid to do anything to Jonathan because of who he was. They're more petrified the fact he was Moses' grandson than anything else he could have ever done.
Because none of Aaron's son had that prestige.
No one of Aaron's son had the prestige. And they were the high priest.
In the next story, yeah. They were ignored.
Exactly that. Precisely. So it was a tragedy that occurred. Tragedy that occurred in that chapter. And that occurred so very early on in the whole book of Judges. Was that story with Jonathan. And subsequently, of course, Benjamin's, which I believe is a tale right off that story. Because of who was still high priest was Phinehas. Dan had already been established. The people had not been taken over by Aram yet in Othniel. So very, very, very early on to have that whole story of Benjamin occur. And Ehud shows up 100 years later. How many years now? 60 years later. As a young man, as a very, very young man, 60 years later, which is most likely the second generation after the Benjamite story. So either most likely his grandparents were going through this Benjamite issue. All of those stemmed off. All those brought together. That's what we went through the past, what, 6, 7, 8 months, whatever it was. Fascinating book. Fascinating prophetic book. Because the simple things that occurred in that book influenced all of Israel.
From that point on.
From that point on. All of Israel's influence. They're all permanently changed. Traditions started here. Stories, problems started here. Changed all of mankind. Changed our history. People in this room, our own history has been changed at this point. Because of simple actions of what people did. I hope it was beneficial. I enjoy going to the book of Judges. I'll go to the book of Samuel next, which is a little bit slower. Not quite as, quote, fun. But the reason I'm bypassing the book of Ruth is because Ruth is not technically classified as a prophecy book. She's a writing book. Now, yeah, you could say, well, yeah, but what about chronology? Well, if I wanted to go through chronology, I would have read the book of Ruth back during, you know, probably, what, Gideon or something like that, or maybe Samson. That's when she lived. Not after the book of Judges. She lived in the middle of it. And for that matter, book of Job should be gone through in the middle of the book of Genesis. Bible's not written in chronology. It's written in subject matter. So treat it as that. God didn't place the book of Ruth at the end of Judges. A human did. People did. We placed it because we thought, oh, well, that's a good, you know, kind of mesh that story in there. Well, that's fine and all, but it doesn't necessarily belong there. But more importantly, it doesn't necessarily belong amongst prophets. Now, yes, I will be including Daniel in my book of prophets, like story sections, because it technically is called a writing. Jewish tradition calls it a writing. That's fine. I disagree. I have my right to disagree with them, so I'll be incorporating that, but that'll be toward the end, which probably will, at the rate I'm going, probably like 3 or 4 years from now. So I appreciate that. Thank you for your time, and wonderful rest of the Shabbat.